It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, as the forced agreement between UPMC and Highmark gets closer to its end, Allegheny Health Network is looking to expand its health services. Also, land trusts. How can they help address Pittsburgh's lack of affordable housing? But first, last Friday, the House and Senate approved a new budget spending plan for the Commonwealth, just hours before the new fiscal year was to begin. The problem, legislative leaders and Governor Wolf haven't figured out a way to pay for that spending. Joining us now is Brad Bumstead, veteran Capitol reporter, bureau chief for the Caucus, the weekly newspaper covering government and politics. Welcome, Brad. Good to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on.
Also in studio is Mark Newpar, WESA senior reporter focusing on government and politics. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So, Brad, you're in Harrisburg. Pretty quiet week at the Capitol this week. Any work behind closed doors? Was it legislative leaders catching their breath to make a...
closed doors. You know, clearly that's what's the way they try to negotiate on these budgets is behind closed doors, and the public can't see into those meetings where they actually do come up with the revenue. The budget part was relatively easy. It's pretty close to what Wolf wanted in a budget, and, you know, it gives everybody a little bit of what they want, you know, like $100 million more for public schools and things like that, things that'll play well in their districts, too. But there is not enough money to pay for the $32 billion budget. It would be incorrect to say there is no money for the budget because tax money continues to come in. But at some point, you know, they'll run out because they're about $2 billion short.
Okay.
So that's really the gap that they have to try to make up here. And they're talking primarily about, quote, monetizing, unquote, income from the tobacco fund, which was part of the tobacco settlement years ago that attorney generals reached. And it's essentially that's borrowing against that fund.
Mark?
Yeah, it you are absolutely right. A lot of this goes on behind the scenes. We don't really get to see it, even if you are, as Brad is, in that building. You don't necessarily know what's going on. A lot of moving parts here. Interesting that you said, though, Brad, that there is not a lot of debate over how much should be spent. Everybody seems to be, well, at least getting close to that page. It's just how do you actually pay for it?
And I do want to talk about, because that is the crucial issue now, how to pay for it. But, Brad, you alluded a little bit in your opening remark about, you know, pretty much in place, in step on the spending. But were there any...
It's been passed. It's been passed by both chambers, and it's sitting before the governor, and he has until Monday to sign it, veto it, or let it become law without his signature. So it's there. That's done deal, but he wouldn't have to sign it if he thought they didn't have adequate revenue. So it's a tough decision, and there'll be a lot of meetings this weekend leading up to that event on Monday.
Yeah, getting to your point a little bit, Kevin, one of the things that I know was a bit of a give and take point was transportation money for school districts. That was something that the governor tried to make some changes and how that reimbursement happened, how that money flowed in. The school districts were extremely worried about that, and the Republicans were able to put some of that back in and made their school districts a little bit more comfortable as they tried to put their budgets together.
Brad?
That's correct. But, you know, again, this budget will probably largely stand in its own right unless Wolf surprises everybody and vetoes it. But the key question is going to be, if they do this borrowing, is it going to bring lawsuits from healthcare interests that would have gotten a share of the current, you know, the next year's income to the tobacco fund? Will the state's bond ratings take dives? Because there's no recurring revenue. It's just, you know, borrowing to cover their debt. There are a lot of unresolved issues, a lot of nervous lawmakers about that bond status, which was, you know, at least one rating company gave a warning yesterday saying bonds would go down. That's happened before. but there's no recurring revenue. That's the thing. This is just a one-time deal. Borrow this money, get the money up front, and have to pay it off. So, bond companies would rather see a tax increase. I'm sure most Pennsylvanians wouldn't, but that provides ongoing, income. Or if you cut spending, that reduces the amount you need. But no one wants to seem to do either one of those.
So as you walk the halls, Brad, this is Mark, I'm curious, what do you think Republicans have the stomach for more? That type of borrowing, which could have those long-term ramifications and maybe even a legal ramification, or expanding gambling and putting some of those machines into bars and maybe even into airports?
Well, they may do both. I mean, the Wolf has said, that if he agrees to borrowing, he will only do it up to $1.5 million. $1.5 billion, that's what it would be. So the legislature has to come up with another $500 to $800 more to actually balance the budget. So there's an ongoing debate right now about whether to do the video gaming terminals and bars and taverns and clubs, up to 40,000 of them, or allowing mini casinos, mini slot parlors, which would be, run by the Gaming Control Board, oversight, and it would be part of the casino system that's in place, and they'd have to be so, far away from existing casinos, so as not to cannibalize their clientele. So, there's an ongoing debate about that. There are other things out there. Some other single, more narrow taxes being actively discussed. But the one thing Republicans have steadfastly refused to say that they will do is a broad-based tax increase that would be a sales or income tax increase, which is where you really get the revenue to fund a budget like this.
As of today, Pennsylvania is one of six states without a complete budget, spending and revenue. The others, Oregon, Wisconsin, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. The Illinois legislature just overrode the governor's veto there. We spoke with John Hicks. He's the executive director of the National Association of State Budget Officers. He told the Confluence that usually when it's a dispute on the spending side of the budget, it's usually one main sticking point.
In a number of these states, one or several issues near the very end of the process have caused some of the stalemates rather than larger, fiscal and budgetary decision making.
So, Brad and Mark, would there be one, I can't even say sticking point since it was approved, was there one that sort of a mini roadblock in the spending? Mark talked about transportation funding for school districts. What do you think, Brad?
The spending, like I was telling you, was easy to resolve comparatively. They agreed on a spend figure pretty early, close to $32 billion, which is what it turned out to be. Then it's a matter of how you divvy it up. There were no huge mega issues that divided them on the spending. There really weren't. Transportation was an issue, and there were others, I'm sure. But, by and large, the big issue has always been how you're going to pay for it.
Right.
And it still is.
Yeah,
and this may not be resolved by Monday. If these leaders tell the governor they're close to an agreement, he's liable to sign it and let them work on it. But it could be, 2-3 weeks before you see revenue bill passed, or not till this fall. Who knows?
Yeah, another thing that I think the Republicans, I wouldn't say it was a point of contention at all, but they sort of rolled their eyes at the idea of how much money was going to be saved by combining some departments. The Wolf administration has been very big on that, touting how much this is going to save and how much better this service is going to be. And the Republicans just said, that's just kind of parlor tricks.
Well, there's no proof that it will actually save money. Maybe it'll be more efficient. I mean, it'll save maybe a little bit of money. I don't know, but no one has that I've heard that has done any kind of independent assessment of it and really established that this will save, X hundred millions of dollars or anything like that. And mergers usually don't because, you wind up with a person who was the head of a department becomes an executive deputy at the agency. And unless you really reduce staff, you don't come up with any substantial savings, more efficiencies. And maybe that's a good idea, but staff is the key to it. You keep the same people or not.
So Pennsylvania House and Senate, they okay the spending plan a week ago, but they haven't resolved how to pay for it all. So how often does that happen, that there's a gap in the passage of both parts of the budget? Here again is John Hicks of the National Association of State Budget Officers.
Only seen that in handfuls of cases, and typically when states are facing significant budget gaps, which, you know, Pennsylvania certainly fits that bill. States will typically run those kinds of legislation, both budget and revenue measures, concurrently.
All right. So, Mark and then Brad, does this happen often in Pennsylvania? You get the spending, the amount of spending, then you figure out later on, and depending on how late that is, how to pay for it?
Yeah, I think that's become a growing trend here in Pennsylvania. Definitely it was the case last year. I've seen it a couple of times in the past. It used to be, as he said, concurrently. You would run these two bills together. You would take a vote on one. You'd take a vote on the next, and it would be on its way. Increasingly, it's just sort of this faith. We will figure out how to do this.
Brad?
Yeah, well, it's part of a – it is an ongoing trend, and it's been evolving over the past two decades because you've had numerous court decisions that have held that state workers have to be paid during a budget shutdown, and there's really no leverage anymore to, you know, keep the lawmakers here to get a budget done. Last year is correct. They had a budget but no revenue to pay for it. The year before that, Wolf's first year was a disaster. That was 2015 because the legislature sent him Wolf a budget that he said was unbalanced, and he vetoed it. So we had no budget whatsoever, and it went into the following year, 2016, when there still was no budget, and it was into February or March before they, you know, came up with a plan, and they were already working on the next budget. So, you know, it almost became a two-year budgeting cycle, you know, but there's just no pressure anymore like there used to be years ago where, you know, welfare workers, welfare recipients wouldn't get paid, and state employees wouldn't get paid, and that was a lot of pressure to get things done. And those things don't happen anymore, and, you know, so there's no recourse. People over the years have repeatedly talked about, well, there should be, you know, legislators should be penalized. We should take away, you know, they shouldn't be paid during any kind of budget impasse or until there's revenue to pay for it, but who would have to approve that? The legislature. And they're going to approve not getting paid themselves? I don't think so.
And Kevin, I think Brad brings up an interesting point that should be explored some other confluence, somewhere in the future, is that idea of a two-year budget cycle. That is something that could maybe, I don't know, it either makes it so difficult that nothing ever gets done, or it actually takes some of this off the plate of lawmakers and they can get other things done. Depending on the way you read the Constitution, it is probably illegal to have a spending plan without a revenue plan. So in those days between the two passages, somebody could complain, but they would have to complain to really take this up to a court case.
All right. So listener Jay Brooks emailed us asking about the recently completed tax amnesty program offered by the Department of Revenue for people to pay their overdue back taxes. Mark, you reported on this. How much could it help? How much was anticipated? And can that chip away at this revenue shortfall?
How much could it help? They expected about $100 million in addition to the about $600 million that is collected by the Revenue Department in back taxes every year. How much does it really help, though? Zero, because that $100 million was already assumed in the 2016-2017 budget. So that is money that was already budgeted and is already part of the shortfall that we're experiencing. Going forward, there is no amnesty unless they pass another piece of legislation.
So, Brad, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the potential revenue generators that you brought up earlier, everything from the borrowing money to the gambling expansion to, and you sort of brought it up and then sort of nixed it because there doesn't seem to be any appetite for it, the broad-based tax increases. Is there one?
Well, I'm not nixing it. The Republicans running the legislature are nixing it. I mean, they're the ones who are saying they're not going to do this, but could there come a point where there's no alternative? You know, who knows?
Okay. So is there one that's sort of leading the way, or is it going to be a patchwork of one-time onlys?
What do you mean?
To fill the gap, to fill the hole, one-time-only revenues.
You know, they've, over the past couple of years, they've raided all these small funds to call together money at the end, and there's really nothing left. The former budget secretary, Charles Zogby, who'd been Corbett's budget guy, said basically, literally, this is almost a direct quote, the cupboards are bare. When he left, there was no more money in any of these little funds that were sitting around and available. So there's not much more to raid there. As far as revenues, there's some additional smaller taxes they're looking at. Excuse me, I don't have the details in front of me here right now, but one is some kind of tax on gross utilities, transmissions or something, right.
Kind of wholesale there energy
some
markets.
Other, yeah. I say small, but they're not broad-based or directly applied to consumers. A couple other things they might be looking at, but none of them bring in the kind of money you get from, you know, even the state's income tax is 3.0%. If you raise that to, 3.5%, you bring in hundreds of millions of dollars. But it's bad politics. Republicans say to raise taxes. For the most part, probably a lot of the Democrats would agree. The governor is running for reelection next year. So politics, permeates all of this as well.
Just to put it into context here really quickly, if my calculations are right, income tax represents about 40% of the revenue for the state. 32% comes from sales and use taxes. So if you're going to raise money, that's where you got to go.
All right. We have 1 minute to go, gentlemen. And you alluded to it, Brad. There's a Monday midnight deadline to sign the budget. What are we expecting? You mentioned that the governor could sign it or it becomes law without his signature, but the revenue might still not be there, at least an agreement on it. Is that correct?
Right. And he could do what he did last year, which was let it become law without his signature. It's the same thing as signing it, but it's just, sends a message that, well, I don't like the way you did this and I'm not going to, endorse this. But it's, he makes, lets it become law, whether he signs it or lets it have out his signature. So the same thing. So that's what he could do. And I think the people I've talked to expect that he will do that, whatever, even if the Republican leaders come to him and say, we have a tentative framework of a revenue package. It's just going to take a while to do this. And it does take a while. There's like 20 accompanying bills to a general fund budget. So they might have to be here for a week to do that. So that's one alternative. Another alternative is to veto it outright. Like he did in 2015. Yet another is to sign the budget but blue line certain items to make it balanced. That's another option that he has. Blue line meaning cut line items. So those are the four things that he can do. There's really not too much else. I think the wild card in all of this is the borrowing and the reaction that we see to that over the weekend, the next couple of days from health groups and other people who might file suit against a budget that's based on borrowing and quote not balanced unquote. So we'll see.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that he will not sign it, and that also gives him some political cover to say it's your problem now.
All right.
You mean he'll let it become law without his signature?
Exactly.
Yeah. Brad Blumstead is Bureau Chief for the Caucus, the weekly publication covering politics and government. Thanks so much, Brad.
Thank you very much.
And in studio, Mark Newbar, WESA senior reporter covering government and politics. After 21 years of producing and reporting difference-making journalism here in Pittsburgh, first at WDUQ and the last 6 years at WESA, Mark is leaving 90.5 next week. Mark, thanks so much for your wonderful work and your friendship.
It has been a great ride.
Coming up, as the final split nears between UPMC and Highmark, Allegheny Health Network is looking to broaden its medical services. That's next when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Katie Zolkowski. Historians and union leaders gathered Thursday to remember the historic Battle of Homestead. They visited the graves of steelworkers who died during the violent strike, which took place in 1892. And Braddock's Superior Motors is expected to open this month. The new restaurant from Chef Kevin Sousa will offer job training, a community bread oven, and produce from Braddock Farms. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been an uneasy, forced relationship between two health insurance giants, UPMC and Highmark, with patients caught in the middle. That relationship will end, and Highmark's care providing arm is sort of gearing up for that. We're going to talk about that with Wes Van Teicher, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Welcome, Wes.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And Chris Mamula is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Good to see you again, Chris.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks. Good to see you also.
If you have a question or comment, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So the competition between the two large insurers is going to increase at the care level. Before we talk about that, some background. The dispute between the insurers goes back years. What was at the heart of it? We'll start with Wes and then Chris, please.
Well, I'll go ahead and defer to Chris since he's been around longer than me on this one, but it's certainly been going on a while.
Is this an age thing?
I was going to say, are you trying to call me old?
All right, Chris, since Wes deferred.
Kevin, it goes back to at least 2013 with the formation of the Allegheny Health Network by Highmark. Or at that time, it was just the formation of it. It's probably predates that by several years, and it started out as a contract dispute, basically of a reimbursement that UPMC felt as though it was very much underpaid for services provided by its doctors for Highmark members. And so it started out as a basic contract dispute and kind of spiraled from there. 2013 was the break where UPMC said, that's it. You are going to compete with us directly in the marketplace. We want to control our destiny, and we're done.
Right. When I think kind of the breaking point was when Highmark said it was going to buy West Penn Health System and form its own hospital network, and UPMC said it would not do business with a competitor in the hospital business. So that's when they finally split ways and the state stepped in and created this agreement that governs what will happen through 2019.
Was this unusual? I mean, because patients, customers were sort of, I don't want to say up in arms, but they were very much concerned. Well, hold it. I have this insurer. Now I can't go in-network services or I won't be able to at a UPMC facility. And so how unusual was that the state to step in and sort of force this relationship?
I think it's fairly unusual. Kevin, if you look nationwide, I think it's fairly unusual to have two providers serving a region in this way. But it's increasingly, and certainly by 2019, but since 2013, it's becoming an either-or kind of thing, whereas in the past, if you had Highmark coverage, you could go to any UPMC facility in years past, and that's going away. It'll be a very much a two-system town.
But this situation didn't just end with state sort of forcing. I mean, we wound up in the state's highest court, right?
Correct. You know, there were lawsuits over several different lines of service, Medicare to employer-based insurance, and the contracts that govern these things. It did go to the Supreme Court. That was the Supreme Court deciding that Medicare Advantage members were protected under this consent decree through 2019, along with some of the other populations described as vulnerable. So they settled that, and then some of these agreements that go through 2019 were vulnerable patients that have Highmark insurance, including seniors, including people with cancer, people undergoing a continuing course of treatment, could still go to UPMC doctors through June 2019. After that, they have to either pick UPMC health plan or start going to Allegheny Health Network hospitals, which are owned by Highmark, or a way that some insurance experts think might be increasingly popular is picking an insurer such as Aetna or United Healthcare, which still contracts with both systems.
Of course.
Yes, that's a great history view of what happened. UPMC has a head start in the marketplace. As a system, they were formed, the head start is at least 10 or 15 years old when they began to put their system together. Allegheny Health Network is much newer, 13. They're still getting their feet, really.
You mentioned the head start. Let me follow up on that, Chris. Is it just sheer numbers, size? Is it a giant and a smaller competitor when it comes to providers, provider services, care services, in numbers of hospitals, facilities, numbers of physicians, et cetera?
It absolutely is a numbers thing, Kevin. But the other side of it is that UPMC controls in Allegheny County, like, I don't know, is it 50%+ of the hospital admissions? Even in the 9-county region around Pittsburgh, it's still very high. It's in the 40%. So they have a lock, basically, on the area. And it is a matter of numbers and facilities.
Well, UPMC is certainly much bigger. And in my conversations with some of the Allegheny Health Network doctors, you know, they're acknowledging that they're not going to try to compete with UPMC on certain things. Western Psychiatric Institute, UPMC, is a 400-bed inpatient psychiatric unit. They do a lot of research. In general, UPMC is further along, certainly in the research side of things. They've been building that up for a long time. AHN is trying to catch up in that and does do a lot of research itself, specifically Allegheny General Hospital, cancer care, some of these lines of services. But AHN is, you know, their 3-year plan that they filed with the state calls for pretty significant growth in volumes, and they are going to need that to be able to compete with UPMC.
What's the purpose? Quick follow-up. What's the purpose of the 3-year plan? Was this mandate? What was this?
Yeah, that was mandated. When the state allowed Highmark to form Allegheny Health Network, the state set a bunch of requirements for what Highmark could do in terms of giving money to AHN, making investments, and is trying to regulate the competition there. And as part of those requirements, Highmark and Allegheny Health Network had to file this 3-year plan, just kind of describing vaguely what they're doing. They're not getting into great detail about how they plan to outcompete UPMC, but they talk generally about numbers and investments and service lines.
I think patient volume and financial projections, too, were part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris and Wes mentioned cancer as a particular cancer care as a particular area of care. Just a couple of weeks ago, Allegheny Health Network announced that they had reached a partnership agreement with Johns Hopkins to open up a $200 million cancer center. Two things. I mean, Hillman Cancer Center, UPMC Hillman, has been around for a while. Is this a direct competition, something they're going to do differently or what? Do we know yet?
Well, they're both doing treatment and research. They're both trying to do the cutting edge treatments. They are both offering participation in hundreds of clinical trials. AHN is positioning itself clearly to make its cancer program better known by partnering with one of the top cancer treatment institutes in the country at Johns Hopkins. They keep talking about how with all these studies coming out all the time, there's lots of new information about how to treat cancer. And they say that by collaborating as broadly as possible, they can make sure that the latest advances are coming here directly through this partnership. And if necessary, AHN patients would receive very specialized treatment from Sidney Kittimal.
I think it's the halo effect too, Wes. It's the Johns Hopkins name attached to a cancer program in the same way St. Clair Hospital has partnered with Mayo Clinic. Even if that's the partnership is only in cancer care, it's almost as though every other service line, every other medical service is golden also.
So in general, how important are these partnerships, if there are going to be more partnerships for Allegheny Health Network? Is it something that Chris alluded to in terms of, you know, the prestige of the partner? Is it a financial boost, a financial help to do it? What do you think, gentlemen?
It would certainly be both. And I've talked to some experts in advertising who have talked about, you know, these are sensible moves for a competitor like Allegheny Health Network to do, trying to compete against a larger competitor in UPMC. I guess we'll just have to see if there are any significant changes in outcomes. But, they're both certainly elements of it.
I think that, Kevin, you mentioned earlier about, I don't think there's any question that UPMC and AHN intend to compete head-to-head on cancer and every other medical service. So we shouldn't, AHN's announcement last week about the $200 million to invest and maybe these other outpatient cancer clinics, up to 10, I think, in the region they want to build, I think clearly is building bulk or just giving them some strength to try to compete. It really is a David and Goliath battle, though, I think.
So there are other areas of care where AHN has been building up or intends to build up to be in direct competition, do we know? Whether it's a women's health services and maternity care or what? Because I think when you think babies, you think UPMC McGee Hospital, but maybe not so much West Penn, and they have quite the maternity ward there as well.
Correct. Yeah, I think AHN is going directly after some of the things that UPMC is best known for. And they're trying to get out the word that they can often offer services that, like UPMC, are top ranked in the nation. In terms of trying to sort that stuff out for the consumer, there are a lot of different sources. U.S. News and World Report puts out hospital rankings where they show that, you know, in certain services, McGee is quite a bit above West Penn. But then you look at another one called Care Checks, and West Penn is actually ranked higher than McGee in that one. So the consumer is kind of left to sort through these different hospital ranking systems, try to talk to individual doctors, see what they can do to try to make their way forward.
I think the consumer is really trying to determine quality in medical care. We were talking about is really a dark art. Steve Foreman from Robert Morris described it as that, and it really is. There is not today an easily accessible, consumer-friendly kind of rating system that tells you Dr. A is better than Dr. B or Hospital A is better than Hospital B. It just doesn't exist. There are so many of these ratings. Wes mentioned U.S. News and World Report. I was thinking of Comparian is another one, which I think is related to Care Checks. It might be even the same company. It's not an easy thing to get through, that's for sure.
Okay. We have just a couple minutes left. I mean, I remember at the heat of the battle between UPMC and Highmark, I mean, it just seems like every other television commercial was one for the other. Do we expect something similar as we get closer and it becomes more direct competition for the actual care services? I mean, you do see them, but is that going to get even more intense? Because let's face it, UPMC could be called a marketing machine, and Allegheny Health Network, as you alluded to, gentlemen, a little bit earlier, is a lot younger than they are. So do we expect more of a media battle, if you would?
I think you can safely bet that, yes. I mean, AHN has been ramping up its advertising campaigns recently, and they've done things, you know, they've been advertising all these partnerships, of course, and they started offering same-day medical appointments. They immediately followed that with a big ad campaign. Each of these changes in services is definitely heavily advertised after they do it, and I think we'll continue to see that. They have this Living Proof campaign now that you've probably been seeing,
right.
And, you know, UPMC is everywhere.
To succeed at this, Highmark has to be smarter. They have to not follow in UPMC's strategy. They can't build hospitals. They can't financially. They can't. And just buying up hospitals is going to be too expensive of an approach. So I think you'll see Highmark doing things that they claim will be smarter, offering lower cost care. I'm thinking of their facility in Pine Township. more of an outpatient approach to care instead of building hospitals, shifting more to outpatient.
Gentlemen, we have just 1 minute left. So it comes down to this. Will the consumer, will the patient benefit from all this? From all this competition, investment in care, expansion of care services, will the patient, will the consumer benefit? Either in cost or quality or both?
That's a great question. I think a lot of economists would tell you, yes, health economists. And depending on which side you're talking to, each side will tell you yes in some situations, no in other situations. UPMC claims that its larger size allows it to streamline services and offer them at lower prices. But that's really difficult to tease out because prices of medical services are rarely public. They're not public in this state. So we're kind of left to gauge quality and see what particularly like your kind of prices your employer gets in negotiations, what you end up paying.
Chris?
Absolutely. I think the consumer will benefit. It's the same rule in competition for business of any kind is going to holds true in healthcare also. It's going to both of these giants are going to have to provide lower cost, higher quality care. And that's the bottom line.
Chris Mamula is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Wes Ventischer is a staff writer for the Tribune Total Media. Thank you, gentlemen, so very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, man.
Land trusts, can they help reduce the need for affordable housing? That's when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Dippy the dinosaur is discovered in the Badlands of Wyoming in 1899. A paleontologist with Pittsburgh's Carnegie Museum found the Diplodocus, or at least parts of it, with funds from industrialist Andrew Carnegie. A life-size fiberglass replica greets visitors to the museum in Oakland. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for July 7th, 2017.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. City Foundation leaders have endorsed community land trust to address a growing need for affordable housing. Started with a feasibility study back in 2015, attracted lots of community buy-in and funding from foundations and government agencies. This week, the Lawrenceville Corporation broke ground on the first 7 land trust homes. Joining us today, Ryan Dito, staff writer at the Pittsburgh City Paper, and Diana Nelson-Jones, who's covered these, lots of other issues for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Great to have you both here. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, great to be here.
All right, so this week, Lawrenceville launched the first community land trust in Western Pennsylvania, but this is not a program unique to Lawrenceville or Pittsburgh. They're like 250 nationwide, Diana?
That's what I've read, yes.
So can you explain how a land trust works?
It basically is, in this case, Lawrenceville Corporation has bought 7 properties. They own the land, and they will sell the house. But the house has to sell to somebody who makes a certain percentage of area median income. And so that is always the case. And there's a formula built in to make sure that as time goes on and incomes go up and market rates go up, the house continues to be eligible for somebody who makes less than 100%.
So again,
yeah, it's usually around under 80%, area median income, which is about $55,000 for a family of 4 right now. But that'll change. That could change over the years.
So again, the trust owns the land, the buyer owns the building, the house.
The house.
Okay.
And the buyer can build equity in that house as long as it goes up. That's the assumption.
Yeah, they'll like the buyer should be able to build a little bit of equity into the house over time. And the house will probably gain a little equity over time, but not the same amount because they don't own the land. The land is usually what gains the most equity over time. So by having that land stay in ownership of an entity like the Lawrenceville Corporation, that basically like maintains affordability for in the long term.
So we hear a lot of terms. We have land trust, land bank. Is there a big difference between the two?
Yes. Well, yeah. No. I mean, the land bank, I believe, is usually a city or a county run entity in which they just, you know, the cities and counties already own a lot of land. I think the city just put out a map this week of all their properties that they own.
3,000.
And they still have yet to establish a land bank, but that land bank is basically just a tool that would clean up those lands and get them ready for development, but not necessarily redevelop them.
There's also the city's reserve, property reserve, where a community development corporation can request a certain number of properties or certain addresses be placed in that reserve so that when they can cobble together the funding to buy them, then they can develop those houses without being profit-driven.
Right. So we spoke with – I'm going to talk a little bit more about Lawrenceville and then broaden the subject how this could or maybe not work in other neighborhoods and communities. We spoke with Lawrenceville Corporation Real Estate and Planning Manager Ed Neusser. He says this method of the land trust, it allows for homeowners to make money and keep the price stable.
And the resale formula sets a ceiling on what the home can be sold for at any year in the future. The balancing act with the resale formula is you're balancing allowing the current homeowner to build equity and create intergenerational wealth while also preserving the affordability for the next generation of home buyer that comes after the current owner.
So the question is, we mentioned breaking ground on seven. Are there plans for more than just these seven?
Yeah, I believe Matt Galuzzo, the executive director of Lawrenceville Corporation, would like to expand it to 25 to 30. And I know that the city the mayor's chief of staff, Kevin Acklin, has expressed hope in maybe this expanding out and just being like a citywide kind of project that maintains affordability. The city of Burlington actually was the first city to establish, a community land trust. That was actually when Bernie Sanders was mayor there. And it's been wildly successful since. I mean, I think they've expanded it to just a huge number there in Burlington. It's kind of maintained affordability, in that Vermont city.
Affordability, preservation. We talked with the executive director, Matthew Galuzzo. He said, preservation.
One of our guiding principles is to preserve the authenticity of place. And part of that is making sure that this is a neighborhood for all. Community land trust, while not the panacea for all of our housing and community ills, is certainly a tool that we feel is going to be really important for us.
Okay, so preservation. How important really is that concept when it comes to land trust, when it comes to affordable housing?
Do we mean a preservation like of affordability?
Preservation of property, of a community, that kind of.
Yeah, well, when properties fall off and they don't get redeveloped, it just becomes exponentially more expensive to then get them back onto, the tax base, because you have to spend a lot of money to, clean them up and, try to convince somebody to, buy into it. So by, preserving those properties, it definitely keeps that affordability not only for the home buyer, but for the city who would have to take over for that land.
But preservation is a challenge in a lot of neighborhoods because some homes are in such bad disrepair. These are possibly architectural gems, but it costs more to rehab some of these houses than it would be just to build fresh. So the challenge is when you want to keep authenticity in a neighborhood, then you have to figure out how to pay for those preservation renovations, and that's difficult.
Right. We started off the conversation talking about this could help in terms of affordable housing. Diana, there's some other solutions when it comes to affordable housing other than the community land trust?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are policy solutions that are citywide. In fact, there are many cities, well, maybe not many. There are some cities, I know Boston is one, that requires that if you are developing land, then the city gives you goodies, tax increments, whatever, infrastructure assistance, then you have to provide a certain number of affordable homes. And you can determine what that affordability will be, whether it's 30%, 30% of the properties being for really low income, or 60% being for median to low. You can determine that. That is a city's prerogative. So that's, I think, a huge way that the city could do something.
Yeah, that's, I think Boston is one of those cities. I think San Francisco is one of those cities. I think Seattle is one of those cities. And, that policy is called, inclusionary zoning. And, basically they pick a percentage. And I know the city has been discussing that as a possibility. I don't know if they're going to move forward with that legislation, but I know that some of the members of council are pushing for that.
I want to get into whether this Lawrenceville model can be used elsewhere. We mentioned Lawrenceville's first, but they weren't the first to explore it. They were the first ones to break ground, actually. We'll start with Diana. Could this be used elsewhere, and what other neighborhoods might be able to either use this model or, adapt it to their particular area?
I think Hazelwood would be a really great place, and I know that they're talking about it. It seems like El Monte is a long way off, but it's kind of like global warming. It's here already.
Right.
There's stuff there, and it's going to keep growing. And people in Hazelwood are talking about this. The problem there, of course, is capacity. Who's going to buy these properties? So they're thinking about it, and if there are properties that are available for them to buy, this would be a great time for Hazelwood to scoop up several hundred properties and get those to be for moderate and low-income people.
Yeah, it seems like the better time to do it would have been when the market is down in a neighborhood and not when it's hot, and that's what's kind of remarkable about Lawrenceville's story is that the market was hot and they were still, able to do this because they were able to raise a lot of funds from private foundations, as you mentioned earlier. I think they saw the need there a lot more to, be very, powerful and kind of pushing that narrative. I think I'd written about this last year, and I think Matt Galuzzo said that about 27% of the home purchases in Lawrenceville were from LLCs, which are typically developers looking to buy up a property and flip it. And so there is this urgency there to try to, preserve affordability before the private market comes in and decides to flip all the houses and basically up it overnight.
Well, I want to get into that. We only have, less than 2 minutes left. But what are the common hurdles? What might be the stumbling blocks? Is it the availability of land in a particular neighborhood community, the cost of it, competition from big developers who want to swoop in and grab and are able to pay a larger price? Diana?
I think in some neighborhoods, like Lawrenceville, that's a problem. The hurdles in other neighborhoods are very different. I think Pittsburgh has so many vacant properties that the big hurdle there is liens and tangled titles and all sorts of legal things that take years and years to solve. But we don't have a lack of places for people to live in the city.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely neighborhood by neighborhood. There are certain neighborhoods like in the West End or in the North Side that it's just going to be hard to get people to buy those properties to even start a community land trust because they have to convince investors or maybe the nonprofit community to purchase those and then start the trust.
And very briefly, we talked to the Lawrenceville Corporation folks and they said they're concerned about future federal funding to help do this because it might not be in the Trump budget. How big of a concern is that, the federal funding, how that could help land trust or slow them down?
It was a huge concern when there was friendly president.
Yes. Yeah.
To these projects.
Yeah. I mean, it's the biggest concern by far is that, as Diana said, when there was a president who was actually friendly to affordable housing issues, it was still hard to get enough funding. Now we have the exact, really the polar opposite of that and, threatening to cut all the funding for it. So it's going to be a very hairy time moving forward.
All right. Ryan Dito, staff writer of the Pittsburgh City Paper. Diana Nelson-Jones, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistant and research from Katie Zolkowski. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next week, hope you have a good week of good news.